media that strengthens the government. We need a media that enriches public discourse, not one that enriches corporations.
Hi, I'm Jane Fonda, and this is WBAI, listener-supported, non-commercial radio in New York.
That's right, WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, streaming at WBAI.org, 9 p.m. Wednesday night, time for Revolutions Per Minute.
Revolutions Per Minute is a weekly radio show from the New York City chapter of the Democratic Socialists of America. Recorded live at WBAI 99.5 in Brooklyn every Wednesday at 9 p.m. RPM's about doing the work to build a democratic socialist future. Each week, hear the latest news, analysis, and organizing experience from the minds and hearts of activists fighting every day in New York City. Join the movement at socialists.nyc.
Yo, what's good, New York? This is Jack Devine, he, him pronouns, and you are listening to Revolutions Per Minute live on WBAI 99.5 FM. We're a socialist radio show and podcast for members of the New York City Democratic Socialists of America. DSA is the largest socialist organization in the United States, with 95,000 members nationwide, and NYC DSA is its biggest chapter. We are run by our 9,000 members and organizers who are working together to build democratic socialism in all five boroughs. The specter and reality of war haunts humanity. The imperialist expansion of NATO and right-wing Russian nationalism continue to escalate tensions in Ukraine, where CIA-backed fascist paramilitaries roam the streets. While Russian invasion would prove devastating for the workers of the world, further U.S. intervention will only make things worse. War is only rational for the profiteers of the military-industrial complex. De-escalation and peace are the only sensible pathways for those who value human life. A devastating war in the Middle East continues to rage on with deafening silence from the corporate media. Saudi jets drop American-made bombs on Yemeni civilians. Bombardment has not only reduced cities to rubble, but has shaken the economy to its core. Dylan and Kothar join us to discuss the horrifying U.S.-backed Saudi-led genocide in Yemen and the efforts by anti-imperialists in the United States to organize to end it. But first, the headlines.
Hey up, New York City. This is Amy Wilson with your headlines for tonight, February 23rd. In local news, Mayor Eric Adams has released his first preliminary budget for the 2023 fiscal year, which begins July 1st. The $98.5 billion budget proposes $4.3 billion in cuts, despite an expected increase in revenue thanks to higher property values. The proposed cuts include a $375 million cut to schools and suspending the city's composting program, while the NYPD and Department of Corrections budget remain the same. Mayor Eric Adams and Governor Kathy Hochul announced a new subway safety program, which includes tasking the NYPD with removing unhoused New Yorkers sleeping on trains and connecting them with mental health services and permanent housing. The plan also calls for the creation of 500 new shelter beds in private rooms. Drivers of four hire vehicles, whose pay rate is set by the city, will see a 5.3% wage increase next month. A relatively small portion of the 380,000 New York City workers lost their jobs after refusing to get a COVID vaccine. The newly formed Homeowners for an Affordable New York, composed of various real estate trade groups, is focusing on preventing the passage of the Good Cause Eviction legislation. The group paid $1.4 million to retain a lobbyist last month and has launched a phone campaign urging New Yorkers to call their state representatives and speak against the proposed bill. On Staten Island, Amazon workers will vote on March 25th whether to form a union. In elections news, incumbent Governor Kathy Hochul has been officially nominated as the New York State Democrats' gubernatorial candidate. Keegan May Williams, a former Manhattan assistant district attorney who was previously running against State Senator Simha Felder, announced that she will instead run in State Senate District 21 in Kensington, Ditmas Park, Flatbush, and East Flatbush against incumbent Kevin Parker and DSA-endorsed David Alexis. Former Mayor Bill de Blasio announced that he will not be running for New York's 11th Congressional District. And in news from the world of anti-fascism, our community is in mourning after a mass shooting in Portland, Oregon, this past Saturday, February 19th. The shooter, who evidence suggests was radicalized by the public postings of fascist sympathizer Andy Ngo, attacked a small group of volunteers who were holding traffic for a solidarity march for Amir Locke, a black man killed while sleeping inside a friend's apartment by the Minneapolis Police Department on a no-knock warrant. The shooter killed one of the volunteers and critically injured several others. Two are still hospitalized as of today. We are devastated by the loss of our comrade, known to her community as T-Rex, and by the physical and emotional injuries sustained by anti-fascists and anti-racists in Portland, Oregon. Too many people have lost their lives to fascism and white supremacy. We mourn for Portland and for Minneapolis, and will continue our struggle for justice in the powerful memory of T-Rex, Amir Locke, Breonna Taylor, and all the victims of racist violence. I'm Amy Wilson, asking you to stay anti-fascist always. Now let's go back to Jack in the studio for tonight's show.
Our headlines are brought to you by The Thorn, an incredible weekly newsletter by NYC DSA Electoral Working Group, covering local politics and radical activism. Subscribe at thethorn.nyc. So I just want to thank both our guests for joining us tonight. Thank you for being with us on Revolutions Per Minute.
Thank you for having us.
So before we get into the subject matter of tonight's show, or might come up in this question, we normally like to give our guests a chance to introduce themselves. And Dylan, I believe this is the second time you've been on the show, and Kotar, you are, this is your first appearance. So I just want to give you both the chance to answer this or any way of introducing yourselves. What social forces propelled you into the movement for socialism, and what organizing have you been involved in?
Sure. Thanks, Jack. My name's Dylan Awol Conley. I use he, him pronouns. I'm an organizer with the New York City Democratic Socialists of America, especially the Anti-War Working Group in NYC DSA, and as well as DSA's International Committee. And I was actually brought into DSA through organizing around the war in Yemen. I showed up to a anti-war working group meeting through Facebook, and it was the first time in my life I'd encountered like real organizer culture, where I showed up, you know, reading about cluster bombs in Yemen and wanting to do something, and was met with experienced and smart people who basically said, all right, here's what you need to do. Step A, B, C, start power mapping, start talking to people, come back to us next month. And I sometimes joke that it's half a joke, but I kind of joined DSA to be able to vote in the anti-war meetings I was already coming to. But also should say, I think came to socialism through that work in another way, in that I was convinced that, you can't address the causes of war without addressing capitalism.
Hi, everyone. My name is Kothar. I am a Yemeni American. I'm with the Yemeni Alliance Committee. So what really got me into organizing for Yemen is because I'm Yemeni and I lived in Yemen during the war when the Saudi UAE-led coalition bombed Yemen that day. That wedding hall was actually my friend's wedding. So I saw Yemen go through like the airstrikes. I saw Yemen go through like internal unrest, the blockade, you name it. Like I saw everything firsthand. And so when I came here, I was like, as a like high school student and going to college, it devastated me that like I didn't see a lot of organizing around Yemen. And so like I know that Yemen Alliance Committee, which was in California, was organizing, was one of the only organizations that is Yemen-led that was doing organizing around Yemen. And so what Yemen Alliance Committee is, it's, I'll give you guys a quick background about it. It's an action advocacy group composed of volunteer Yemeni American organizers that initially formed in the Bay Area of California. And we've also started chapters in Michigan and New York, which I lead in New York. We are nonpartisan. Instead, we insist on the sovereignty of Yemen, and we came together to push back against our government's role and the oppressive policies on our homeland. We organize protests, draft and sign and on to advocacy letters, coordinate lobby visits with lawmakers and elected officials. We create toolkits and talking points and write for various outlets on the plight of Yemen for Americans, because we know warmongering is systematic. Our goals have been to push policies that are for the peace and stability of Yemen and away from like global militarism, imperialism, and away from waging endless wars, basically. Thank you.
Well, I'm so sorry to hear the devastation that you experienced firsthand. I can only imagine the horrors of encountering that, and my greatest sympathies towards you and towards everyone who's lost their life in this truly horrifying conflict. And I just want to remind our listeners that you are tuning in to Revolutions Per Minute. I'm listener sponsored WBAI in New York City, broadcasting at 99.5 FM and streaming on your favorite podcast app. Today, we are talking about the genocide in Yemen and the organizing efforts here in the United States, and particularly here in New York City, to fight back against it. And I think a common theme in both your answers, although you had very distinct paths to it, was that the horrors of this current crisis in Yemen is what kind of pulled you into organizing, into activism. And so I think it's critical for our listeners to have a sort of background to what's actually happening. So what is the current situation in Yemen? How many lives have been lost? And who is responsible for this horror?
Okay, so Yemen, look, the numbers really, there. It's over 300,000 Yemenis that have been killed, and two-thirds as a result of Saudi UAE airstrikes. But you have massacres throughout, just last month in January, the Saudi UAE coalition disabled Yemen's access to internet through bombing the telecommunication buildings and then committing massacres throughout the country, killing over 70 people, including bombing a prison. So who's responsible? Like, of course, you have internal factions that are also funded by the same coalition which is Saudi UAE, and then seven Arab countries. And so before I get into the bigger picture, I want to give those who don't know like how it started, just a background into like why did we get where we are. And so in 2011, when the Arab Spring took the MENA by storm and the democratic wave entered Yemen fairly early, right after Tunisia and Egypt, and then Yemenis, especially the youth and women poured into the streets in a country that is highly armed, second to the U.S. per capita. And then, civil unrest in Yemen continued for the next 3 years, And in September 2014, the Houthis took over the capital and put Hadi under house arrest. And so on the eve of March 26, 2015, that's almost 7 years ago, we are entering the seventh year of this aggressive war on Yemen. Saudi Arabia, under the leadership of MBS, the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, who had only been in power for 2 months, launched an airstrike on Yemen, abruptly escalating a civil war into a regional inferno under the guise of restoring the legitimate government of Yemeni President Abdul Rabbuh Mansour Hadi. And so you had aerial bombing, targets from border stations, shellings from the sea. Yemen's tiny military base was destroyed early on by the Saudi UAE airstrikes. And so I just want the listeners to know that the war on Yemen was not announced from Riyadh. It was actually announced from D.C. Saudi Arabia continues to do what it does. It's because it's been giving the green light. And since then, Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, and its coalition, which includes Kuwait, Bahrain, Sudan, Egypt, Morocco, Senegal, and then Qatar stepped out of the coalition in 2017. And then you have Jordan's role is really undefined, and they've just been bombing Yemen and supporting and are part of the coalition. So, and this coalition is backed and supported by the U.S., the U.K., and other partners who have been providing the coalition with intelligence support, targeting assistance. They've also been Green Berets, U.S. Special Forces at the Saudi-Yemeni border. The U.S. used to refuel Saudi warplanes mid-air until 2018 after Khashoggi was murdered by the Saudi regime. And in addition to military support, the United States under the Obama administration, which continued under Trump and is now under Biden, provided the coalition with weapons from U.S.-made bomb manufacturers such as Raytheon, Lockheed Martin, General Dynamics, and Boeing. And there have been over 120 armed contracts totaling $120 million a month. So these war manufacturers are really benefiting from this war. And I can go back into tie in how after war on terror, after September 11, military spending increased 50% in comparison to spending on every other non-military program, like education or healthcare or public transit and science, which only grew by 13% comparison to the defense budget and whatnot. So war is really a well-fueled machine, and we know that the U.S. is supporting the Saudi-led coalition to appease their ally and for war manufacturers here in the U.S. And Saudi Arabia really has been after Yemen for decades. There's a history of invasions, land grabbing, and currently Saudi Arabia has a geopolitical interest in Yemen, wanting to control Bab al-Mandeb Strait, which is the fourth most important trading route in the world. It's located between Somalia and Yemen, and it's over 5 million barrels of oil flow through it daily, and it's a getaway to Red Sea. So it's really a focal economy. It's focal to the global economy and whatnot. And within all of this, the impact on the ground, which we really don't hear about, and I think it shouldn't be talked about a lot, is the blockade. And a lot of people hear about the war, the clashes, and the brutal part is that receives very little attention is the blockade. And the coalition imposed a naval land and air blockade that is, again, backed by the U.S. Navy. You're going to see how, the U.S. is, it's not just complicit. It has an active role in this aggression on Yemen. Blockade has been imposed on Yemen since March 15, which has severely restricted the flow of food, fuel, and medicine to civilians. And it continues to prevent much aid and nearly all commercial imports from reaching Houthi-controlled ports, which has a disproportionate impact on civilians' access to, major resources. And, just to tie this into, what's currently happening is that Biden is reconsidering an FTO designation of the Houthi. And so this is a Trump policy that he has rolled back last year, after pressure from activists. And so if he goes back into this policy, he is putting Yemen on, he's pushing Yemen to famine. It's currently 24 million people out of the 30 million people, Yemenis, rely on international aid. And so if the FTO designation is actually put in place, this will criminalize any orgs from working inside of Yemen or working in Houthi-controlled areas. And the Houthis control, Ansar Allah Houthis, they control 80% of the Yemeni population. And so you do the math. It's devastating and it's really disgusting how Biden's even considering this to appease to the Emiratis. And so, like, what does the impact look on the ground? So over, like, 300 Yemenis have been killed by the violence. Over 18 million are in desperate need of food and aid. 90% of Yemenis do not have access to electricity. Over 16 million Yemenis do not have access to health care. Over 3 million are internally displaced because of the war, the blockade. And Yemenis are effectively boxed, and not to mention most Yemenis would rather die in Yemen than flee. And for those who do flee, they hardly have any means to do so. And like other countries are not willing to take in Yemeni refugees. And 10 million people are a step away from famine, and 7 million people are malnourished. As with all the crises, women and children are the most vulnerable. Like 4.5 million children and pregnant women are acutely malnourished. And this will like impact infant maternality development. And over 16 million don't have access to clean drinking water. And this has allowed fatal diseases such as cholera and diphtheria, which should not even exist in the modern age. And you have every 10 minutes a child dies because of such diseases that are preventable. And it has a trivial effect with the blockade. It has a trivial effect because we use trucks to import water into rural areas. 70% of water is imported to those rural areas. And if you don't have fuel for the trucks to run, then water is not going to reach those rural areas. And so you see how like the blockade has a trivial effect on the everyday to day life, or like for the hospitals that need fuel because Yemenis don't have the luxury of having hospital 24 hours. So hospitals that are spared from the bombing need electricity to run. And so there's you need generators, and for those generators they need fuel. And so because there's a shortage of fuel because of the blockade, it makes it harder for the generators to run. And so like, This is another systematic way of like killing the Yemeni people.
Thanks, Kothar. Could I actually just jump in for listeners, because you mentioned the FTO designation. For those who don't know, FTO stands for Foreign Terrorist Organization, and it's a legal designation. So it means that an organization, you know, gets their assets frozen, has certain restrictions working with other international organizations. And the reason it's such a problem for designating the Houthis and a foreign terrorist organization is that really the only, the main international organizations they interact with are humanitarian aid orgs trying to get aid into northern Yemen. So sorry to interject. I just wanted to clarify that for listeners.
Thank you for the clarification, and I think what's been laid out here in stark terms is the really horrifying reality that's being created by the imperialist activities of the U.S. and Saudi Arabia in alliance with one another, that over 300,000 are dead, millions are displaced, millions are suffering under depraved conditions where they lack access to health care, to food, to water, that the economy has been utterly ruined, that this is a barbaric war that is being waged by Saudi Arabia and the United States against Yemen with a broad coalition of imperialists or client states in the region that are committed to the American imperial project. And this is at the same time And I think this is a key point that you mentioned, that we have so many people suffering in this country from lack of healthcare, from lack of funding for education, and this money is going to the war machine instead, that you have, as you mentioned, Raytheon and the other military contractors rolling in the dough at the cost of so many lives internationally and lives here in the United States. And you've already begun hitting on this, but I just want to maybe reiterate this for our listeners. But what are the root causes of the genocide in Yemen? In what ways has the alliance between the United States and Saudi Arabia led to this tragic loss of life? Like, how does this fit in historically? How has this partnership between the United States and Saudi Arabia been something that's targeted the oppressed peoples of the world beforehand, and how are they doing this in maybe the most barbaric way thus far between their relationship right now?
So I think that the connection between Saudi and the UAE and the United States share a very, very strong relationship, historically speaking. And so, and Yemen is not afforded that relationship, and it's because of other reasons, right? And so, when it comes to Yemen, the genocide and the roots of it, it's like the bombing. If Yemenis are not bombed, the blockade is systematic and it doesn't really get much attention. And if it's not bombing, it's the airports, the continuation of another part of the blockade that receives little attention, and how can people travel? Like people with threatening medical conditions that need to travel out the country, they don't have the means to leave the country. So there's many ways that the Saudi imposes on Yemen that systematically targets Yemeni's life. It's not just bombing them anymore or the airstrikes. It's other ways that they have been killing Yemen and Yemenis. And another impact of that is the economy. Our economy in Yemen has trickled. The rial is no longer affordable for the average Yemeni. If Yemenis don't have someone in the West or outside of Yemen who has a great job, who is able to provide for them, then they'll die if they're not. And then one time I had a family member say, if we don't die by airstrikes, we die because of the blockade. If we don't die because of the blockade, we die because of the starvation. And this is a sad reality of Yemen. And while we do have internal unrest, it's just the root problem here. It's definitely Saudi UAE aggression and intervention inside of Yemen. And they have a history of doing it and meddling in our internal affairs. I remember when Biden came into power, he promised to end arms sales to the Saudis and whatnot. And people were especially people on the left and anti-war activists were really content that he's finally acting on his promises. And then he stopped offensive arms sales to the Saudis, but Saudi Arabia went into Yemen on the pretext of it being defensive. So they always find loopholes to continue their relationship on the expense of anyone in country. It's really profit before people. And whether it's Saudi, whether it's the U.S., and that's how they operate. They don't really operate with the lenses of human rights, with the lens of people over profit. It's really the opposite. It's profit over people, and that's why, again, really people power is so important. And we've seen that, the language that they use when how they frame the tensions between Ukraine and Russia, and there is currently anti-intervention when it comes to Ukraine, but yeah, the hypocrisy when they're supporting imperialism and intervention inside of Yemen. So you just see they operate from a framework of profit instead of instead of like the people. And that's why it's so important for like the people tonight. And so like Dylan, if you would like to add on into like the alliance, please feel free.
Sure. No, thank you, Kothar. I just wanted to mention, you touched on this, but the weapons sales that the U.S. sends to Saudi Arabia are really part of this sacrosanct relationship, where we agree to send Saudi Arabia weapon sales and back them internationally and basically provide diplomatic immunity for things, including the Khashoggi killing and the war in Yemen. And in return, Saudi Arabia, as one of the bigger oil exporters, continues to sell their oil only in the American dollar. It's sometimes referred to as the petrodollar, but allows the U.S. dollar to remain valuable as a global reserve currency and, is a very, very important part of that relationship for American capitalists who need their dollar to go a long way internationally.
Yeah, that's a crucial point. I think when you think about the broader international situation with the United States, even though we've this country has lost a lot of its industrial production capacity, is no longer the largest creditor in the world, its ability to maintain the petrodollar, the exchange through oil of international currency, and maintaining the dollar as the world's primary currency, is in many ways the main way that the U.S. maintains its international dominance alongside its powerful military. But I just want to remind our listeners that you are tuning in to Revolutions Per Minute on listener-sponsored WBAI in New York City, broadcasting at 99.5 FM and streaming on your favorite podcast app. Today, we are talking about the genocide in Yemen, the efforts by NYC DSA and coalition partners to fight back against this U.S. and Saudi-led genocide in Yemen. But before we get back to our regular scheduled programming, I just want to talk to our listeners about, you know, helping out with the station. I'm Jack Devine. I'm not Jane Fonda. I don't have the name recognition as our previous pitcher, so I can't. I don't know if I'll be as motivating for you to donate to the station, but I think it's absolutely essential that we have a radio station where you can hear this show, Revolutions Per Minute, that NYC DSA can have its own radio show on the air. And there's a few ways that you can support keeping a show like this on the air, keeping a station like this on the air, where you hear critiques of American imperialism, where you understand that the role that Saudi Arabia and the U.S. relationship has in the broader construction of global capitalism, global imperialism, and the devastation that has done to a place like Yemen. So in order to do that, in order to become someone you can support the station, support a show like this, you can become a WBAI buddy. You can go to WBAI.org and go become a buddy. Click on that right there. You can call 212-209-2950. Again, that's 212-209-2950. Or go to WBAI.org. You can make a one-time donation if you want. You can become a buddy of the show where you're a recurring donor. You get to $25. You get to become a democratic participant in the station's internal democracy. So that's something that differentiates this as well as having a show like this on the air. So to do that, go to WBAI.org or call 212-209-2950. And so I want to get back to discussing not just the horror that's taking place in Yemen, but what's happening to fight back against it. So how long has NYC DSA anti-war working group been fighting to stop the genocide in Yemen? And what has been your strategy thus far?
Thanks, Jack. So we've been involved basically since the fall of 2017, when Ro Khanna first introduced the Yemen War Powers Resolution into Congress. We've definitely been mostly following the lead of other organizations in New York, including the Yemeni Alliance Committee. But the War Powers Resolution was an opportunity to act in Yemen because, I'll just explain really quickly, it's a legal mechanism where Congress can basically affirm to the executive branch that the U.S. is currently engaged in a war or a conflict that Congress didn't authorize. So it's basically saying, hey, Mr. President, this war is illegal. This was created in response to Nixon's bombings in Cambodia. And the important thing for us was always that it has a time limit attached. So once a war powers resolution gets introduced, it has to be voted on. There's about 15 days it gets in committee, and then I think 3 days out of committee. So it's a tight turnaround, and it allowed, you know, legal pressure during the Trump administration with a Republican-controlled Senate. The anti-war working group was involved in, we helped organize some of the protests in March 2018 when the Saudi Crown Prince came to visit New York City. We kind of followed him around. He's here to list Aramco on the stock exchange. But it was really later that year that, you know, the campaign started to pick up nationally. There was the horrible school bus bombing in Sada on August 9th, where the Saudi Air Force dropped a laser-guided Lockheed Martin bomb on a school bus, killing 40 children. They later had to admit there were no military targets in the area. It's one of the clearest examples of the many war crimes that Saudi Arabia has committed in Yemen. And then shortly after that, October 2nd, Jamal Khashoggi is murdered, pretty clearly at the hands of a Saudi death squad, which I'll just remind people that while campaigning, Joe Biden said that he believed the Crown Prince ordered it. So that's when we start to see mainstream support for pushing back against the Saudis. The War Powers Resolution does actually get passed under Trump in March 2019, despite Republican control of the Senate, and Trump vetoed it. This was, you know, a huge setback to us at the time. It put our work in the anti-war working group on pause for a while and left many Yemenis and allies in this fight. To kind of just hope that the next administration would bring something different. I think Joe Biden clearly picked up on this. He was campaigning at the time and promising part of his campaign to reverse Trump's policies on Saudi Arabia. He said he was going to make Saudi Arabia a pariah state for their murder of Khashoggi and role in the war in Yemen. In January of last year, we joined a global day of action that the Yemeni Alliance Committee helped organize, along with 300 organizations in 28 countries, one of the biggest anti-war demonstrations since the Iraq War. And we joined in New York City in front of Meeks's office. The demands of this were basically, you know, new administrations coming in. Biden's made these promises. We want him to act on them immediately. There's no reason to extend this war any longer through U.S. support. So in New York City, we rallied outside of Gregory Meeks's office. And that's where we are actually coming back to now. I'll talk to this a little later on March 1st to return because our demands then haven't been met. Gregory Meeks is important for New York. He's the he's the Democrat in New York's 5th congressional district, which is comprised of Rockaway and much of Eastern Queens and Jamaica, Cambria Heights, that area. He's chairs the House Foreign Affairs Committee, which means that he's basically the most important Democrat in the House for anything that we want to accomplish in terms of foreign policy. He replaced Elliot Engel when Jamal Bowman ousted him last year. And so he was newly coming into this last year when we gathered outside his office. So far, I think it's worth mentioning that both he and Joe Biden have been have really done very little to distinguish themselves from their hawkish predecessors in Trump and Elliot Engel. Joe Biden, like Kothar mentioned, promised to end U.S. support for offensive operations in Yemen, including relevant arms sales. But we've really seen since then, you know, the saying goes that the best defense is a good offense, and that the U.S. has basically just the U.S. and Saudi Arabia justified continued support for the same operations in Yemen by relabeling them as defensive. I mean, just this last month, Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin announced that the U.S. is going to send a warship into and commit fighter jets to Yemen to shoot down Houthi drones directly, which is a major escalation. The U.S. military has never been involved that directly in this way. It's kind of been important for the U.S. to maintain some plausible deniability in their distance from the Saudis. So, you know, that's what we're seeing now, and we're seeing twice as many civilians in Yemen dying this month as in October of last year when the UN withdrew their war crimes monitors. So, you know, this is all to say we met with Meeks last year. He expressed concern. Concern is great, but doesn't get you where we need to go. And it's time for him to, you know, get with the program. We don't have, it's almost 7 years into this war. You know, it's unacceptable at this point to say, we're going to wait and see, we're going to hold Saudi Arabia accountable. I mean, the increase in civilian bombings is just evidence in this last month that doesn't happen. The bombing of a prison that killed 70 people in Yemen is further evidence, but we really didn't need further evidence. We had that already. And it's just outrageous that we could be asked to continue support for this war any longer and keep collecting evidence in the form of deaths of civilians.
So yeah, despite all these pronouncements by these Democratic politicians, the war continues to march on in a really horrendous way. So I think the anti-war working group has done a lot to build up an important coalition to keep pushing to end this. But the Democratic politicians like Joe Biden keep approving arms sales to Saudi Arabia in a really horrific way. And I want to ask you one more question related to that, but I do just want to let our listeners know that we have around a little less than 15 minutes left in the show. So this time, we'd love for you to call in and talk to us about what we've been discussing today, or if anything is on your mind that you think that we might have a good response to. So we can give us a call at 212-209-2877. Again, that number is 212-209-2877. So let me just throw this question your way. Why is it so crucial for socialists and New Yorkers to stand in solidarity with Yemeni people? And how can our listeners get involved in this fight?
Thanks, Jack. Yeah, I think the humanitarian reasons that we've already discussed, you might consider that a reason. You might consider the fact that Yemenis are our neighbors here in New York, and you know, it's enough to work with in solidarity with our neighbors. And I think Kothar put it beautifully earlier when she said that that Saudi Arabia puts profit over people. I mean, as socialists, when we talk about putting people over profit, we are talking about, you know, restructuring our political system to center the value of human life and human dignity. And the war in Yemen is just a policy of a government that clearly does not value or center that. I think New Yorkers probably know this intimately by now from living through the past 2 years of coronavirus and the failure of our country in many ways to respond to that, the massive amounts of deaths, the nursing home deaths that were covered up in New York, also the breakdown of infrastructure during the recent hurricane. But I'll also just say that I think if you're an American and a New Yorker, you're probably now you've been getting a lot of arguments for why you should be supporting U.S. you know, military intervention to protect human rights in Ukraine. You guys touched on this beautifully last week, so I won't repeat anything. I think it's pretty naive and ahistorical to expect the U.S. military to protect human rights, and we merely have to risk war with another nuclear superpower to do that. But I think if people are not convinced, I would just ask anyone who finds that remotely convincing to consider a situation like in Yemen, where the U.S. has intervened. The U.S. is directly supporting the Saudi coalition. And we know for a fact, after 7 years, that it is making the situation worse, that it is destroying human rights in Yemen. I'll very quickly just mention that this protest, which we're doing on March 1st in front of Meek's Jamaica office, has just been endorsed today by the New York Committee for Human Rights in the Philippines and the New York chapter of the Malaya Movement, which is extremely exciting to be organizing alongside our Filipino comrades in solidarity. They've been pushing for the Philippine Human Rights Act with the anti-war working group in DSA for the last year or so. And it's a very similar demand. You know, stop selling weapons to countries, Philippines, whether the Philippines, Yemen, or Philippines, Saudi Arabia, or Israel, that we know are using those weapons to commit war crimes. So that I'll leave it with that.
I think you made a number of really strong points there. And I think it's crucial to emphasize we hear this this march towards intervention based off this human rights framework that, as you're saying right now, the U.S. is involved in a horrendous campaign that is utterly destroying whatever you would describe as human rights, in the killing of over 300,000 people, the displacement and starvation and destruction of the lives of millions more, and that this is not unique. We can look into the war in Iraq for another situation where devastation was routed, the way that the U.S. has treated Afghanistan since its withdrawal, and the way that it's kind of blockading aid from being sent there in a sensible manner. We can tie it back to the number of dictatorships, including Saudi Arabia, that the United States supports that trample upon human rights, the long history of U.S. support of right-wing dictatorships in places like Latin America. The list could go on and on and on. Max, do we have any callers on the line?
We do not.
Well, then I'll just remind our listeners that the phone lines are open. You can call in at 212-209-2877. Again, the number is 212-209-2877. And I think there's, just want to give you a chance again, Dylan, to let listeners know, how can they get involved in this fight?
Absolutely. Thanks, Jack. The first thing I would ask is if you are available on Tuesday, March 1st, please come join us to rally in front of Gregory Meeks's office in Jamaica, in Queens. We're rallying at 12 p.m. His office is at 15301 Jamaica Avenue. And, yeah, you know, we have a kind of an opportunity living in New York and being close to the you know, most important Democrat for influencing foreign policy. So if you've been moved by anything you've heard today, please come out and join us. We've got great speakers, and it'll be an important follow-up to our demands from last year. If you can't do this, if you can't join us, I'd encourage everyone to call the National Switchboard, which is 1-833-STOP-WAR. That's 1-833-STOP-WAR. If you call that, you'll be connected to your representative, and you'll be read a list of basically the demands of this national coalition around Yemen. One demand that's not included there is one Kothar mentioned earlier, which I'd encourage you to urge your congressperson, especially Schumer and Gregory Meeks, if you can, to oppose a foreign terrorist organization designation for the Houthi movement or Ansar Allah, because such a designation would result in just disastrous consequences for organizations like the Red Cross and you know, basic mainstream aid organizations that are at the moment keeping people afloat in northern Yemen. So it's very simple. Ask again. You can do that by calling 1-833-STOP-WAR, and you'll be connected to your representative. We have more resources available on every75seconds.org. Kothar unfortunately had to jump off, but you should find the Yemeni Alliance Committee online. You can find them on most of the social media. They're continuing to lobby around this. They'll be continuing after March 1st. So if you're interested at all in supporting them, please connect through social media. And then the New York City DSA's Anti-War Working Group, you can connect with us if you're interested in organizing with us by emailing antiwar@socialists.nyc. That's antiwar@socialists.nyc. We'll be meeting probably the day after on March 2nd. And if anyone is interested in supporting longer term efforts, hopefully not too long term, to end U.S. support for this brutal war in Yemen, that would be the meeting to come to. But again, really quick, if you can, please come join us at Meeks's office in Queens, his Jamaica office, 15301 Jamaica Avenue, at 12 p.m. on Tuesday, March 1st.
Well, thank you for sharing all that great information with our listeners, Dylan. I'm sure they really appreciate it. Max, do we have any callers on the line? All right, I'll take that as a no. I think what this conversation we've had today, and Dylan, if you have any final thoughts, feel free to chime in.
We do have a caller or two.
Oh, we have a caller. Okay, great. Never mind. I was going to do a whole little rant, but I'll prefer to hear from the caller. What's Hey, caller, you're live on Revolutions Per Minute on WBAI. What's your name? What's your question and or comment?
Hi, my name is Melinda. I was wondering if Saudi Arabia has the power to continue this war without American support, and how much leverage America has to end this war.
Thanks, Melinda. That's a great question. Yeah, Saudi Arabia most likely does not. It's worth pointing that out. Their military is, their actual military is very small. It's comprised largely of American contractors. And it's really Saudi citizens mostly just fly the planes in their air force. They fly the planes that are bombing Yemen, but those planes until 2018 were refueled by the U.S. And one of the deals that Joe Biden made this past fall was for a $500 million helicopter maintenance contract. Like, this is the kind of stuff that gets justified as defensive support, but that Saudi Arabia really depends on in order to continue using their airplanes, helicopters, offensively in Yemen. So that would be a major blow. And similarly, it would be a major blow if the U.S. just took their foot off the brakes of any attempt by the international community to respond to this. So, you know, diplomatic immunity is a huge thing as well.
Yeah, I think those are really great points, Dylan. I think it just highlights the fact that, you know, the Saudis' power in the region, and its immense power in the region is dependent on the U.S. And that the fact is that the U.S. is responsible for the fact that a far-right extremist, like semi-feudal government that is fascist in many ways, is a dominant power within the region. And I think there's a lot more you could go into the history of the Saudi-U.S. Relationship, the role it's had in undermining leftist movements and movements of a variety of movements, whether it's communist or social democratic within the Middle East, and how they've collectively undermined those movements together. But we don't really have time. We are coming to the end of the show. I just want to thank you so much, Dylan. Thanks, Kothar, to also joining us on Revolutions Per Minute. This has been Jack Devine with Revolutions Per Minute. We'll see you organizing your workplace out in the streets. And we'll catch you next week, Wednesdays at 9 p.m.
Thanks so much for having us, Jack.
You're tuned to listener-sponsored, non-commercial WBAI in New York, and this is This Day, February 23rd, in Racial Injustice. On February 23rd, 2020, 25-year-old Ahmaud Arbery was shot and killed by two white men while he was out jogging in Satilla Shores, Georgia. Mr. Arbery's killers, an ex-police officer and his son, were allowed to leave the scene and face no consequences for months. Local officials refused to fully investigate the murder and misrepresented the circumstances surrounding the shooting, and rejecting efforts to hold the men accountable. A police investigator who called Mr. Arbery's mother, Wanda Cooper, lied to her, saying her son had been involved in a burglary during which the homeowner killed him. Mr. Arbery, a high school football star, ran regularly in the neighborhood. That morning, he jogged past Gregory McMichael, a 64-year-old former police officer and retired investigator for the Brunswick District Attorney's Office, who was standing in his front yard. Mr. McMichael called out to his son, Travis McMichael, to tell him that Mr. Arbery, quote, looked like, unquote, the suspect in a string of break-ins that had occurred in the neighborhood. The two men grabbed guns, got into their pickup truck, and began chasing Mr. Arbery, shouting at him to stop running. Once they caught up to Mr. Arbery, Travis McMichael jumped out of the truck with his shotgun, startling Mr. Arbery. After a struggle over the gun, Travis McMichael shot Mr. Arbery, who was unarmed, three times, killing him. When the Glynn County Police Department arrived on the scene to investigate, they let the two white men go home. In early May 2020, nearly 3 months after Mr. Arbery